Earlier in the week, I tweeted out a photo from a storefront church, at Deacon Punnett is my Twitter handle. And the storefront church had a picture of what they purported to be Jesus, but it looked exactly like Kenny Loggins. Exactly like Kenny Loggins. Feathered hair, blonde highlights. It's very funny. And it what it got was a bunch of great jokes. People were responding to to that Kenny Loggins Jesus. Anyway, one thing led to another, and there was a lot of shots about Kenny Loggins music, but that's one thing we could all agree on. There were some great tunes along the way, and that was one of them from Loggins and Messina. So it was my way of making up to Kenny Loggins. But if he'd seen the picture in that church, he'd agree too. That's just a, Jesus shouldn't look like he just came off the slopes of Aspen. At least not in my opinion. Anyway, so we're loading up the calls right now. We'll go ahead and we'll grab your call too. Joining the conversation, we're talking about the early days of the mob in New York. The Last Pirate of New York is about maybe the very first modern mobster. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Rich Cohen is also the author of Tough Jews, Monsters, Sweet and Low, When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead with Jerry Weintraub, and the book about the Chicago Cubs curse. Hey, Rich, were you in the Alex Gibney ESPN doc about that, about the Chicago Cubs
About the
curse?
Cubs?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. That was a really good, like 30 for 30 on ESPN. Was about that night. I didn't know if you were. I just saw it
You mean
not too
about
long
the
ago.
because there's
Yeah.
also the one about the Bartman ball.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, the Bartman
Yeah.
ball. Yeah,
No.
I'm sorry. Okay.
That was such a painful thing.
Oh, no kidding,
Took me
man.
years to sort of be able to talk about it.
Me too. And not to mention the famous fold against San Diego and what was it, like 84?
Yeah, well, that
Oh.
was my childhood. That's
Yeah.
basically created my whole view of the world, which is everything ends in misery and pain.
Well, that was the way I felt in 1969 when I had my first paper route and I would duct tape a transistor radio to the Angel handlebars on my Cheetah Slick, and I would listen to the Cubs on WGN. And the year that they folded against the Mets, it was hugely impactful in my life, and I never forgot it. It was weird. All right, so we'll go to Barry, who's in South Carolina on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking the early days of gangs in New York and mobsters and the Last Pirate. Barry?
Hello there, Ian. First on to last night and first on tonight.
There you go. Talking to Rich Cohen. Go ahead.
Yes, as a matter of fact, didn't I hear you and Rich mention a gangster named Poole from Providence, Rhode Island?
Well, we were talking about Bill the Butcher Pool, but I don't know. Is he from Providence?
Okay,
No, he
well,
was
the
in New
thing
York.
is,
I was
my
talking.
name is Barry Poole, Poole, and my daddy was from Warwick, Rhode Island. And he grew up during the Depression, I was telling Donna, and he had lots of money, his family did. And he used to tell me that one of his uncles was a gangster in Providence, which would be about 1903 to 1930.
Yeah,
Anyway.
that pretty common. In fact, Providence was fairly mob ridden.
Yep.
Thank you, Barry. Thought on that, Rich?
No, just probably you've got some mobster money in your family there. It's Providence was tightly knit to all of this important city, and all the way back, in the time of Albert Hicks, it was a huge city. It's one of those cities that for a moment seemed like it could have challenged New York, and it made sense that he went there because it was another big port.
Right.
And when you get into this, because then of course when you talk about Albert Hicks, because I'm talking about gangsters told stories about gangsters who told stories about gangsters, then you wonder, well, what stories did Albert Hicks hear
Right.
growing up? And we don't know for sure, but there was a lot of piracy and a lot of famous pirates in on the coasts of Rhode Island and Connecticut, and in the largest mass execution in the history of the United States was in Rhode Island, where I think 21 pirates were all hung on one day in the early 1800s, which is stories that Hicks would have heard about.
That's very interesting. I spent a time in New Jersey, not long after 9/11, college, and I was doing radio out there on the East Coast, and I learned from a lot of people that I worked with, some of whom, I think most of whom were Italian-American, that if you say you've got a mob member in your family, you probably don't. The real mobster families don't ever talk about
it. Right. So, well, it's just, you know, you have a book about everybody, I become like a everybody wants to know, like, as if I know who everybody's family is who is in the mob. But it's like,
right,
you know, everybody's, there's a whole conspiracy idea that Jesse James lived beyond when we know that he died.
Right.
And there, you can meet tons of people who say that he was hiding in their barn, he was in their house. Because
right.
Everybody just wants to be connected to something special, you know. And good or bad, it's something special and unique in its American history.
But, you know, interestingly, though, I mean, I think the difference is maybe with the mob is there are a lot of low-level mobsters. There's a
right.
lot of people who are sort of barely connected. They owe a favor. They give a favor from time to time.
Well, like, I'll tell you one that you might not know, which is, you know, remember Sid Luckman?
Sure.
Okay, so Sid Luckman, Bears quarterback, and first modern quarterback in the NFL who – by the way, threw in 7 touchdowns in 1 game, a record that's never been broken. Been tied, but never broken. And if you think about when he did it, they didn't throw like they throw now.
No, it's true. Know. Right.
And he went to Columbia, and he was a great college football player. And nobody could figure out why he went to Columbia, because even then, it wasn't a big football school at that moment. It had been, wasn't anymore. And The feeling was always because he wanted to play for that one coach whose name was Lou Little. And then George Halas traded up to draft him for the Bears and all the stuff. But it turns out that one of the reasons is he had to stay in New York because his father, talking about journalism and true crime,
right.
his father's name, Meyer Luckman, who was an associate of Murder, Inc. Now, so he wasn't really in Murder, Inc., but he worked with them. And his father had found out that his brother-in-law was embezzling from him, and they owned a trucking company, and his father, with one of the guys of Murder, Inc., basically beat his brother-in-law to death.
Oh, no.
And was arrested, and then the police just let him go. And they had a wiretap of these guys talking about how the New York police had been given $100,000 just to let him go.
Huh.
And all this was going on in the New York papers while Sid Luckman was being drafted by the Bears, and they never connected the two in the papers. So on the front page of the newspaper, you'd have the story about this trial and this huge scandal, which led to the, you know, DA in Brooklyn having to resign. And then
right.
on the sports pages, you'd have all the stories about Sid Luckman. And I think that Sid Luckman's father died in Sing Sing while Sid Luckman was basically winning the MVP in the NFL.
Wow. That is one of those. And there's, I think that may also... speaking back to something you'd mentioned about the early 70s, I think that kind of secret history of the United States, I think all of the stuff about the Godfather was kind of Watergate inspired in many regards, because it made you think, well, what else don't we know?
Right.
You know, if all this could be going on. All right, we got, let's go to Pat in San Diego on Coast to Coast AM for Rich Cohen, the last pirate of New York. Pat?
Hi. I was just calling in. I was listening to your show, and my great uncle was Al Capone's lawyer. And
which one? What was your great uncle's name?
His name was Joseph Roach. You can find it in the internet and stuff. And he had I think his partner's name was Perillo. But Uncle Joe learned law in prison. He shot a man that robbed him in a card game. And then Woodrow Wilson pardoned Uncle Joe when he was in prison for murder, and he became all the president's lawyers and stuff. He ran the Ku Klux Klan out of Indiana, and they bombed his house and killed his my dad's nephew, and it's all on the internet.
That's
I actually been studying it lately.
Sidney Roach, that's his name, as you said. What's his name?
Yeah,
Roach.
My great uncle's name is Joseph Roach, but there's
Joseph
a book
Roach.
Called Perillo May or Capone May Go Free by Perillo, and the whole first chapter is about my Uncle Joe.
That's interesting. I didn't know about the only one I knew about was Sidney Korshak.
Thanks, Pat.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
I had a friend growing up in the neighborhood who whose father taught Al Capone's grandkids how to swim. And the only reason that's interesting, so it was after he had gotten out of prison and he was living in Florida. And he was, but he had kind of lost his marbles by that point. But he,
yeah. He had syphilis, didn't he?
Yeah, he had, so his brain had gone syphilitic, and he was very nice. He wasn't, but his father, you saw the story about coming over to the backyard pool and teaching the grandkids how to swim. There's a lot of those stories in Chicago, and most of them I think are true, kind of stuff. East of the Rockies, Mike is in Grand Forks, North Dakota for The Last Pirate, Rich Cohen. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, how you doing? Nice to talk to you guys. I've had a fascination with the mafia for a long time. I lived in New York City from 75 to 79, and they had people like Vincent Gigante, the Chin, and I was wondering, what can you tell me about him? Because I remember walking down the street a couple times and seeing this older guy in a bathrobe begging for change. I wonder if you can shed any light on that, if that was actually him.
Yeah, well, I don't know who you actually saw, but he hung out in this little park that I mentioned at the beginning of the book called like St. Anne's Triangle. My memory is not so great right now, but it's a little tiny a park, and he'd walk around in his bathrobe and just kind of mutter. And the thought was that, you know, he ran, I think it was the Genovese crime family. It's late, so my mind's not incredibly sharp, but
I think you're right.
They called him the Chin because he didn't even want any kind of code name of himself ever on a wiretap. So you're never supposed to say his name. You're supposed to just point at your chin. And in that way, there'd be no record of him on any kind of wiretap or transcript that the FBI would be doing. And this was his defense, which is he couldn't be running a crime family because he was mentally unfit. And he was, you know, battling to himself. The story was always that he'd go home, take off his bathrobe, and was wearing a three-piece suit underneath it, you know. And before he died, they pretty much did show that that the whole thing was an act, that he was completely sharp and with it, and he carried it off for a long time. And in the end, they prosecuted him. And his name is Gigante, I believe. And what's interesting is, like, in this New York crime stuff, I'm probably going to mix this up a little bit, but Murder, Inc., so Murder, Inc. was run really by this guy, Louis Lepke Buckalter, who was the only crime boss ever convicted of murder, because they have so many layers, talking about Watergate, they have so many layers of insulation between themselves and what they do that they can never get him on murder. That's like Al Capone and tax evasion or whatever.
Right.
So they get him on racketeering, they get him on RICO, but there was actually a guy who turned rat, they so-called, which is Abe Kid Twistrellis, who ran Murder, Inc., who testified against Lepke and put Lepke in the electric chair. And when Lepke died, that gang was taken over by Albert Anastasia, who his nickname was the Lord High Executioner. Albert Anastasia was killed by two guys in the Park Central barbershop, the same place Arnold Rothstein was killed, same hotel. And the people who did it, I think, was the Chin and Crazy Joe Gallo, if I'm memory right, were the two guys that had killed him. It's all connected. It's just a small group of people doing these crimes. And it's really wild, because with the whole Jeffrey Epstein thing and him hanging himself or whatever happened there, I just kept thinking about Louis Lepke, because Abe Reles testified against all these different people, culminating with Lepke. But he was being held by the police, protected, at the Half Moon Hotel in Coney Island, New York, with a bunch of other people that were testifying against the mob. And they had 16 police watching these guys 24 hours a day, and somehow, even with all the police protection, Abe Reles went out the window of the Half Moon Hotel.
Right.
And the New York Post had one of the greatest headlines of all time. They called him the canary who could sing but couldn't fly. And the next person that he was going to testify against was going to be Bugsy Siegel. And that was another one of these crazy cases where the police said they kept investigating. They could never come up with a good explanation. And finally it said he was playing a practical joke on the police by pretending to climb out the window and fell to his death. Years later, Frank Costello came forward and said that they basically, the police didn't kill him, but the police were paid to just disappear for a little while. That's right. Again, like the Godfather, you know, remember at the beginning of the first Godfather when the police protection is just gone.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the hospital.
That's another, to me, like the Godfather and the Natural are very similar because they took all these legends that are based on truth and he turned them into a novel. And the Natural, I always think of, you know, in the Natural, it starts with the player getting shot by the woman in the wedding dress. Well, that, you know, really happened to Eddie Waitkus, who was shot by this deranged Cubs fan, of course, Cubs, you know, wearing a veil in this hotel room because Eddie Waitkus committed the cardinal sin of being traded to the Phillies and abandoning her, you know.
And I'm reminded, too, of the great Speed graphic photos that were collected from those mob hits too. And that those, if you, you know, I'm sure you've seen them, but that, that particular camera style, the film, the negatives, just, you know, what amazing resolution on those shots.
Well,
especially
the Albert Anastasia the... one's a really famous one of those.
That's what I'm talking about.
He's in the barbershop with the sheet pulled over his face. Every time, because I get a shave at the barber sometimes, every time I do that, I think, uh-oh.
Here it comes.
Because he was getting a shave, and he had the towel, the hot towel on his face, so he didn't see him come through the door.
We have so many interesting questions up. I hope people hold. I think we're running to the bottom of the hour. Let me see. I'm just going to check the clock real quickly. Just by, okay, yeah, I got enough time. Let me get to, I think the next one would have been Andy in Toronto on a wild card line on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Andy.
Hi, guys. You're mentioning a lot of great movies. One that comes to mind is Once Upon a Time in America, which brings up a focus on the Jewish mob. And James Wood, he seems to get out of it, but he never really does. And he kind of like is brought into the wider mob of, you know, of what we call American society. And that kind of leads into my question. Your guest mentioned that the prime feeling of a lot of these new immigrants was to try and, you know, get up and out of where they were. But I guess my question also says, how hard was that? Because my question was, did you discover any Protestant mobs when you were doing your book? And if not, wouldn't the wider society have been considered the Protestant mobs because it wasn't really that easy to get in? And one last thing, Ian, you mentioned from The Godfather that scene where the actors, they go and they watch like a little production, which would have been a stage play, more like an opera scene, and they're singing in Italian. I saw that more along the lines of the genesis for the creation of Hollywood, because you got to remember at that time, it was really Jews and Catholics that went out to Hollywood. And if, you know, if Jews were doing a variety of things, the Catholics were in the acting and producing and that sort of thing.
Well, I was with you up to the last part. I don't think that holds, but the other part's really interesting. That there is a whole theater tradition that it's not related to film, not like in the way that Edison laid the groundwork for filmmaking, which was actually in New Jersey, and then went to Hollywood, Florida, and then out to California. But that, I don't think that's the same thing. But but let's pick it up on that other question about the Protestant gangs, because there really weren't a lot, but there's a reason for that too. And your point about, could we just look at the wider society of America as being the Protestant gang that they were all trying to get into? Interesting proposition. We'll see what Rich Cohen has to say about that. And then everybody else, hang on. I promise you we'll get to you. We'll give you the numbers next, too, to join the conversation on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, you know, it is an interesting proposition about Protestant gangs. Rich, I'd be curious to see whether in your research you came across any specific immigrant populations that were Protestant in origin that also had a gang that would have been representative of that period.
Because I don't think, usually it's ethnicity more than religion that they come out of. So Judaism is religion, obviously, but it was more like as an ethnicity, and it was a specific group of Jews, mostly Jews from Russia and Poland, you know, wasn't Jews from like Spain, you know, or England.
Or Germany. So, which had come over already in a big immigration wave.
Right. Germany had come over 40, 50 years earlier. So there had been big German gangs, though, and some of those people would have been Protestant as well as Catholic. So
Lutheran.
But they were defined by their ethnicity. So Judaism is just interesting because, you know, one is like for me, it was a different way to tell this. I was fascinated by gangster movies and gangster books, and I wanted, to be honest, I wanted to write one, and I wanted to write one that hadn't been written, and this was like a new way to tell it. And the fact is that these people were Jewish and their rituals were Jewish, just was a different take on it. And it was interesting that you'd have, you know, the biggest underworld event of 1932 would be Saul the Bug Workman's son's bris.
Right.
And you would have, you know, a lot of Catholic gangsters there too.
Right.
But the event was a Jewish ritual, and that was different, and that was interesting, and that was very New York at the time. So, but in a way, the religion is kind of incidental, except that it gives them a kind of grounding in this sort of traditional community. Yeah.
That's really interesting. In fact, I'm reminded that there was the first wave of German Jews that came to the United States came with money. They came.
Yeah, they were like the Warburgs. They were banking
right.
families, and they were traders. And a lot of Jews came from, you know, the very old Jewish communities in the South, like in New Orleans. There are people that were involved in the sugar trade who'd come from places like Brazil. And there'd been the Inquisition that was exported from Spain, and they had to leave, and they were in the Caribbean, and they were in, you know, Spanish and French cities around the Caribbean, and the French cities were very, because of the French Revolution, they were very open,
right.
liberal to all different people.
But that was what, when the Jewish mob didn't start until the Russian Jewish immigration came in waves, because they had no money and there was nobody
right.
looking out for them.
And
so
the people that were sort of the most, gave them the hardest time, maybe, were German Jews.
Oh, totally.
Their social position was threatened by
right.
these people. And that's why a lot of Jews would come through New York. A lot of everybody came through New York and ultimately Ellis Island. And then they sort of pushed it that Jews, they didn't want all those Jews coming through New York. So they started coming in through Galveston, Texas.
Right. Yeah, very interesting.
So if you meet Jewish people from Kansas and you ask, where did your ancestors come a lot? We'll say they came through Galveston, Texas.
Yeah, that's very compelling. And I know in St. Paul, where I lived for a while in Minnesota, that the German Jews were very well established, and they resented and they were afraid of intermarrying with the Russian Jews that were coming in. And so
that's what I was saying about my
yeah,
parents. I mean,
right, they were...
And basically, you know, in New Orleans, I think the New Orleans Mardi Gras floats, which were big social clubs, they didn't allow, by the 1920s, Jews were not allowed to participate in that. Well, the first king of Mardi Gras in New Orleans was Jewish, German Jew. But then when all these Russian Jews came in, then all these lines started being drawn. And that's what the German Jews were afraid of. And, of course, the Russian Jews, as you would, really resented it.
Right.
You know, that they were seen just because of the bad
sure.
luck of history that they wound up in this different place, and they were very poor, were sort of, you know, looked at as that they were something inferior.
Not to mention the vice president of the Confederacy being Jewish, too. First time caller line, Matt is in, he's in the Twin Cities. He's in the TC. Hey, Matt.
Oh, Mr. Pundit, Mr. Cohen, first time caller coming in from Minneapolis. Thank you very
Glad
much.
Glad to have you.
I just want to say, I know my time's short. Love you, Ian. Been wanting to call
you.
In for like 20 years. I think you're the best host, and you have
oh,
the best
nice.
Guest.
I miss the Twin Cities.
Long story short.
Go ahead.
Excuse me?
I said I missed the Twin Cities. It was a great place.
Oh,
I love
yeah.
it.
It's right, it is. Right now, you would not have missed it last winter.
True.
Anywho, long story short, I'm a Native American Jew, and so I was curious. You know, you're talking about ethnicity, anthropology, all that stuff. I'm in financial services. In addition to having a strong academic background. And curious, Mr. Cohen, first of all, Shabbat Shalom. Secondly, whether or not you ever studied the Native American, Italian, Jewish influence in the casino gaming industry, and also whether or not you can care to comment on the movies of Scorsese is certainly influencing, I would say, probably the purpose of your research. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Well,
after,
I guess
it is
first
after...
question is, what do you mean by Native American Jew?
Yeah, what do you mean by
well,
that?
First of all, I don't know if you know anything about anthropology, but in the Native American, I would say certainly academia in the United States, They've certainly identified the lost tribe of Israel, one of them at least. And then when you actually go, and my grandmother herself, Beverly, she researched her ethnicity and all that stuff. And there's an Ashkenazi influence, I would say, probably within the Native American genetic makeup. And it certainly predates a lot of what history's taught, you know, that we know, at least in the United States. And then secondly, based off of that, I think that there's a lot of so much opportunity for research in this sector, I would say. And
all right. Well, the Conversos certainly intermarried with Native Americans. We are after sundown, so it's no longer Sabbath, but it is the Lord's Day for those people following that. So what's your thought on that, Rich? Where do you want to go with that?
Well, I don't know about lost tribes because they're lost. So, but I do know that there was one of the Indian nations, and I don't want to say which one because I'll be wrong, who they did do tests for, and it was a large percent had been Jewish. I thought they were sort of Sephardic Jews, and it wasn't that they were a lost tribe. They decided that, like you said, they were Spanish.
Yeah, they were the Conversos.
Who intermarried and had children with, and, you know, several generations went by. And, you know, it's just interesting. It's just America. It's just big mosh pit of every nation in the world.
Crazy story. Mosh pit is exactly right.
Yeah.
I like that. All right, let's go to Joe, who's in Long Island on Coast to Coast AM, east of the Rockies. Joe?
Yeah, hi, Richard. Great topic. Two quick questions. First was, what did you find about women participating in any way, or did they just lay in the background, or were they strategists?
That's interesting.
And then, do you find some of this like, almost like the book Animal Farm, where it's like a bigger allegory involved with these gangs, you know, that you could apply to world affairs or even World War One, World War Two. And also, I just mentioned there was a line in Warriors, that movie that was kind of farcical on gangs, where it said, we got to get to Coney Island, you know, the idea of the topography of the city and an oasis such as Coney Island.
Right. Well, that's interesting because I just wrote an article not long ago about trying to argue that 1979 was like one of the best years in movies that's overlooked. And that was the year the Warriors came out.
Warriors.
And the Warriors is interesting because it's based on, and now I'm forgetting the name, but an ancient, I think, Greek story about the, you know, Greek army that's trapped deep in Persia when the king is killed, and they have to fight their way back to the coast, and they see the water, and they say, the water, the water. And that's kind of what happened to that movie, The Warriors. So,
well, I remember reading the book, The Warriors, back in when I was in high school. That was a huge book, and we were so happy they were making it into a movie.
Yeah.
But there was another thought in there, too, about women and gangs. And what was a bigger role?
Well, not if the men were around, there really wasn't the women had very traditional roles in the gang at that time. And if the men, and they were mostly kept in the dark because, like, they didn't want to pass it on to their kids. But what's interesting is if you go back earlier, back to the time of Albert Hicks, and he mentioned Scorsese, because Scorsese does get into this in Gangs in New York, where he has, who is it? Who's, Cameron Diaz, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
Who plays, you know, those were real. Those were these, like, Hellcat Maggie, who had her silver teeth filed to points. You know, those were real people who had a collection of ears behind her bar. So basically that was before Arnold Rothstein. That's the whole point. And after Arnold Rothstein, the gangster world really copied the business world of America. It was, you know, in The Godfather, when he says, we're going to be bigger than U.S. Steel, that's a real quote from a wiretap.
Yeah.
You know, and they very much wanted to model themselves on that as people in suits, you know, and very respectable. So in that, it followed all the traditional roles of the rest of society, and women pretty much had the roles that would copy the roles of 1950s America. So, you know, and it's interesting because, and then it is an allegory, and that's why the Godfather is referenced so much. You know, the whole idea, just one example, is when they go to war early in the first Godfather, and he said we had, you know, he gets rid of Tom Hayden as consigliere and says, you're not a wartime consigliere. I mean, how many times does that come up when we're talking about secretaries of state or secretaries of defense in this country?
Right.
It gives you a basic prism through which to see the rest of the world. And even the idea of, you know, Don Corleone sitting down with his enemies and making peace because war is just going to kill everybody. I mean, that's how every peace treaty is reached in the world, basically.
We'll go to Richard in Oklahoma City and then Al. Sorry about that, Al. I'll get you in a second. Richard?
Gentlemen, Blount County, Alabama has a cave called Banger, B-A-N-G-E-R Cave. When it was accessible and you could get to it, it had a stone bar in it, a dance floor, a stage, all made out of rock. And it was an Al Capone hideout in Blount County, Alabama, which is just north of Jefferson County in Birmingham.
Interesting. Didn't know.
It sounds like a very cool place to visit, I'll tell you that, if it has a bar made out of rock. But I'm not really that – I don't know the ins and outs of Al Capone's entire life. I do know that he was a Cubs fan.
Yeah.
And there's pictures of him at Wrigley Field with his guys behind him, and you can see their guns in the picture.
Thank you, Richard. I do know, too, that when I lived in the Twin Cities, that there's a strong connection between Capone and the city of St. Paul, which provided neutral, it sort of allowed the mob to go on vacation. And so I believe I've stayed in the Al Capone suite at the St. Paul Hotel. That's what I was told anyway. And but there were tunnels and all of that other stuff. And they were expected when Dillinger or other people came through, they were expected to check their guns with the local gendarmes and not commit any crimes while they're not rob any banks, not do any kidnappings. And if they did that, then they would be left okay. Al is in Utah on Coast to Coast AM. Al?
Yes. Your last statement there was a beautiful loop. Lead into my question.
Great.
I know that in Hot Springs, Arkansas, that was neutral ground for a lot of bad men going back to the James Gang. And then in the 1920s and 30s, even Al Capone and others would take the train down to Hot Springs, Arkansas, which had famous old resorts and wonderfully luxurious hotels, still has them. And you know, go soak in the waters. But it was neutral ground for the mafia and a lot of other groups. But I was recently told by a friend of mine, now I was raised in Spokane, Washington, and I'd never heard this before. Spokane was essentially a retirement town for the mafia.
Hmm.
If you lived long enough in the mafia, got up in age, that was one of the places you could move to, and it was neutral for all of the mafia members.
Hmm.
And a lot of the other bad guys. I was just wondering if the
author
Mitch? You have on tonight.
Well, I know that about Hot Springs, Arkansas, famously as neutral ground and a kind of resort where a lot of meetings happen. Interestingly, I know I keep going back to this, but it keeps coming to my head. It's also where the first spring training in baseball started with the Cubs. And that's one of the reasons they went down there, by
Is
the way.
Is it really?
I mean,
really
the early
cool.
history of baseball was very connected, and pro sports, to the underworld, because one of the big appeals of all sports is it gave people something to bet on,
right.
You know, and that was a big part of it. I don't know about Spokane, Washington, but you make me think. I could think about what do I know about, because most of the gangsters I had written about in my books, they didn't make it to retirement age. But
right.
the ones who did, like Meyer Lansky, retired in Miami Beach, and there's pictures of him walking his little dog. Lucky Luciano was deported and grew to old age in Naples. And I know a guy named Doc Stocker went to Israel. And, you know,
which is where Meyer Lansky wanted to go, but they wouldn't let him.
They wouldn't let him. He wanted to go partly because his friend Doc Stocker was there.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't let him because the U.S. government wanted him back.
Yeah.
And Golda Meir was the prime minister at the time. And she had lived in Milwaukee, and she knew all about the mob. And she said, we don't want the mobsters. And we don't want them here. I mean, that's specifically that generation
but Spokane,
of guys.
Spokane would be interesting because it just might be so far west
that
it couldn't have possibly come back to haunt them. You know, there wasn't like the Poconos, which would have been
right,
close enough to cause trouble.
Gangster with the grudge went with on a college visit with his daughter and ran.
Let me go to Craig in British Columbia. That'll wrap up all the calls. Hey, Craig.
Hi, guys. I'm wondering when Lansky and Siegel got involved with Las Vegas.
Well, I know Rich will know that. Go ahead.
When they did? Well, after World War II, I mean, I was just reading about it because I was reading a history about it that was a little bit more in depth, which is there was another somebody else running it before Siegel that he took it over from. I forget who was trying to build this big kind of modern, our idea of a modern casino as opposed to kind of an old West casino, and the idea that Las Vegas would be where gambling and prostitution were legal and close enough to L.A. and a place planes might stop. Because intercontinental travel became new. I mean, that's the same reason why you had sports teams moving to major league teams on the West Coast, because now you could fly after World War II coast to coast, and that could be a place people could stop. And somebody had started to build that casino. It was somebody else.
And they ran into money trouble.
What?
And they ran into money trouble.
Yeah, and then Siegel took it over.
Yeah.
And he was supposed to fix it, and at first they assigned it to him. He didn't want it. And then when he got it, he realized how much money they were pouring into it, and he skimmed money off of it, basically.
Right.
And they found out, this is what I always heard, that they found out that he skimmed money, was in a bank account in Switzerland, and his girlfriend, Virginia Hill, was going back and forth and getting this money. And Meyer Lansky, who grew up with him, couldn't protect him because he'd stolen from the mob.
Yeah, can't do that. And that, again, another famous speed graphic photo of the body of Bugsy Siegel with that shot in his eye. Rich Cohen, you were wonderful. The Last Pirate of New York, I don't want to forget to mention that it really, it's the story that goes back way before this. So if you enjoy these mobster stories and you enjoy the way mobsters talk about other mobsters, then you're on the Richard Coe train here, because that's what it's all about, is going back to the very first mobster, in a way, the first gangster, the first one that everybody talked about. And I think he makes a pretty strong case for that being this guy, Albert Hicks, the Last Pirate of New York, a ghost ship, a killer, and the birth of a gangster nation. Rich, what are the Cubs going to do for the rest of this season? Are they going to pull it together?
They're going to sweep the Cardinals in the last season, which I'm going to go home and see, in mid-September, and then they're just going to, you know, blow through the playoffs and face the Yankees in the World Series. Finally, a recurrence of the Babe Ruth called shot. We'll finally get our revenge for that World Series the last time they played.
I am so going to hold you to that. And I hope you're right, and that would be fabulous. And if it's true, we'll have you back on, and you can tell us all about it. I wish I could get there with you.
All right,
nice talking with
you. Talking.
It was fun, and thank you, and say hi to your sister for me. The Last Pirate of New York. If you go online, you can sign up for Coast Insider. You can listen to all of these shows, go back and forth, and listen to, coming up tomorrow night, George Knapp's going to be talking. Well, go online at coasttocoastam.com and see what George has for tomorrow night, too. It's been a fun weekend. Thank you to George Norrie for allowing me to step in last night. Enjoyed those open line calls quite a bit. And I'm in the middle of a thunderstorm, so I better get before my power gets knocked out. It was just a week ago when I took a tree on my garage. So I pray for you. Pray for me that doesn't happen again. Deus te amat. And I do too.